Television's most explosive science show is on tour with a stop in East Lansing this weekend. The hosts of Discovery Channel's Mythbusters will present Behind the Myths, featuring onstage experiments, audience participation, and their usual unorthodox approach to science. WKAR's Melissa Benmark spoke with Mythbusters co-host Adam Savage, who, along with Janie Heineman, will be bringing a slightly unplugged version of the show to Wharton Center. Melissa began by asking Savage how many explosions he'd presided over during the show's 10-year run.
I think we just did some stats on this, that it comes out to just shy of 3,000 over the last 10 years.
Wow, that's impressive.
That's across both teams. I'd say I'd be responsible for about 2,000 of those.
Okay. Well, I mean, in skydiving terms, your first 1,000, you're considered a veteran. So, 2,000, you're getting up there. So what is the Cliff Notes version of how you ended up hosting Mythbusters? Because it sounds like a lot of your previous work was behind the scenes with various kinds of artistic design and special effects and that kind of thing.
It was actually behind the scenes. I did, however, start out wanting to be an actor when I was about 15 years old.
Oh, really?
That was the first thing that I thought that I really wanted to. Well, actually, the first job I ever wanted was to be a designer for Lego. The second was to work on Star Wars. And then somewhere in my early teens, I started to act in the school plays, and I really thought that that's something that I wanted to do, and I studied it very seriously for about 5 years, stopping somewhere around the age of 19, and then really ending up making things for a living for about more like 10 or 15 years. I started out in graphic design, assistant animation, moving into theater, and theater I learned scenic painting, master carpentry, rigging, welding. I worked as an assistant for an artist for a while and learned some more advanced machining and electronics work there. And the theater work here in San Francisco, which I was doing in the early 90s, caught the attention of a special effects shop that was being run by Jamie Heineman. And he brought me in and hired me in my first real job in commercial special effects. I worked for Jamie for about 5 years. When I couldn't stand him as a boss, we stayed professionally cordial, but I moved on and worked in the toy industry and then up at Industrial Light and Magic on films now, on special effects films.
And you did do Star Wars a bit, yes?
Yeah, I actually did get to work on Star Wars, episode 1 and 2. And then when Mythbusters called in early 2002, they were cleverly looking for people who already had experience building everything. And that's exactly the kind of experience that you get when you're working in special effects. There's no technique that you might eschew if it's going to help you out. And good special effects guys tend to be real materials polymaths. And it just turned out to be a perfect match of material with personality. Jamie and I, the show ended up really sort of growing up around us.
And were you hesitant at first to go back to working with the person who had previously been your boss?
No, I didn't. We sent in a demo reel. It really all happened before. It wasn't like I made a conscious decision at any given point. Jamie called and said, there's people called, they want a demo reel. Do you want to help me out with this? And let's do it. And I said, yeah. And then we sent in a demo reel, and they loved it. And they showed up 3 weeks later to shoot the pilots. We shot the pilots for 6 weeks. And then the show premiered in January of 2003 to a really great rating. And we had been told that Discovery was going to take a couple of months to make this decision. In fact, they called us within a week and said, we're picking up the show. We start shooting in a month. And Jamie and I have never stopped filming Mythbusters since that moment. We've been shooting 46 weeks a year for the last 10 and a half years.
Wow. So your background is in building pretty much anything, and you do that on the show. But what kind of objects or projects, if any, do you just find frustrating and difficult to build?
That is a really good question. Almost everything carries with it a certain amount of frustration. But any given material or process in and of itself isn't usually inherently frustrating. Isn't usually inordinately frustrating. It's usually when you're trying to marry either two or three different techniques or genres of making. It's funny. It's like no matter how long I've been building stuff, and now I do most of my building in my head before I sit down. You know, it's like I do a lot of problem solving just mentally before I ever touch a material. But still, within almost any project that I'm doing, there's this time I just think, I have no idea what I'm doing. This is, I shouldn't be wasting this time. You know, I don't know electronics as well as I wish I did, but that doesn't stop me from diving in if I have to. There are all sorts of things I'd love to learn that I haven't gotten enough chance to do on the show, like really more advanced welding, and very specifically like steel manufacturing, like suits of armor. I've always wanted to work with more elaborate equipment to manipulate sheet metal.
Your show is notable for having lots of busting on it. Cars, dropped food, airbags, explosions. How do you take Mythbusters on the road to a genteel velvet-curtained theater like Wharton Center without causing the place to look like a hotel after a visit from Keith Moon?
Well, yeah, we labored a lot about figuring out how to take Mythbusters out on the road. And, you know, the biggest problem is was that we knew from the get-go we weren't going to be bringing actual experiments onto the stage. And the real problem with that is, and we knew this, was that, you know, on the show, if we do an experiment and nothing happens, we can edit out the boring bits, but you can't do that on stage. So we knew that we had to, in order to keep the evening rolling, we wanted to do something. And we didn't just want to show up and do a bunch of science demonstrations either. We wanted it to be invigorating and exciting. And where we really latched onto was an understanding that it was in the sense of humor that we realized we could bring a Mythbusters experience to the stage and in audience participation, which is something we don't generally do on the show.
Right.
And so in the course of the Behind the Myth tour, we bring, I think, at least a dozen people up on stage over the course of the night. And we play with them, we mess with them, we alter their expectations and confound them, we pit them against each other. And because we're doing this, and we bring up young kids, we bring up older people, we bring up everybody, every show is really different, and that keeps it really fresh for us.
It seems like about every person with scientific connections that I interview, I ask this question of, but do you think there is a correlation between kids being allowed some unstructured time for, lack of a better word, creative destruction? Do you think there's a correlation between that and having some aptitude for scientific thinking later in life?
I totally do. I'm a big believer in letting your kids be bored, because in that tension can be created a lot of really interesting personal experience. It is something that's harder and harder to do these days. I've got twin 14-year-olds. And I do think that, you know, the ability to, I guess a lot of the structured game and play that goes on these days is all around success. And it's not around competition, and it's not around failure. And I think that when you're screwing around by yourself, you're going to scrape your elbows, and you're going to, you know, get confounded by something you want to achieve, but you're going to learn that regular wonderful periodicity of failure that tempers all of our personalities and I think makes people much more bearable to hang around.
I promise to limit myself to only one really self-indulgent question.
Okay.
I understand you worked on Galaxy Quest, which is one of my all-time favorites. What did you do on Galaxy Quest?
I only worked on Galaxy Quest for about 2.5 weeks, but it is full stop my favorite movie I worked on the whole time I worked at Industrial Light and Magic. Not because of what I got to do. I mean, I just built a small bit of the dry dock when the ship is coming out of the Thermian dry dock and
oh,
it scrapes against
oh
the side.
Oh, God, which is just excruciating and one of my all-time favorite scenes because it's so funny and so long.
Right, and so there's a shot where you can see this. You know, all the Thermians standing in formation in multiple windows.
Right, right.
And that is actually a practical effect. It's a piece of hardware that I laser cut and put together as a light box with film strips of actors behind them. And it took me 2 weeks to build and light. It took another painter another week to paint it. And it's not a truly spectacular piece of model making. It's exactly what was required. But I spent so many years working on films that I thought were real dogs And it was nice to work on one that I think of as a nearly perfect film.
So there are myths, and then there are myths that are within a TV program's budget. If you had unlimited resources, money is no object, what myth would you jump at the chance to bust?
Well, we'd build a rocket ship and go to the moon and come back with a piece of Apollo hardware demonstrating that man had already been there.
Any other ones you can think of right offhand?
No, that's the main one. You know, that's the primary one that gets us both kind of excited. The idea of going to space and actually making a trip like that, with money and budget being, of course, no object.
Well, Adam Savage, thanks so much for joining us, and we'll enjoy having you here at Wharton Center over the weekend.
I can't wait. I'll see you guys this weekend.
For Current State, I'm Melissa Benmark.